Welcome to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. It is really a pleasure to talk to Michael Walsh today because he's got a new book out called A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. It literally just landed on my doorstep, and I had to get Michael on here to talk about it with us. And so I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, Michael. I've skimmed a little bit of it. First off, thanks for doing this, and congratulations on the publication of the book.
No, thank you, Ed. It's really a pleasure to be back on with you.
Well, and I know that you are a pond hopper. You go back and forth between the U.S. and Ireland, which is interesting these days. We were talking about a little bit before we started recording, but I'm glad that you're here. I guess the first thing I'm going to ask you is, what's the book tour going to look like? Are you doing a tour this time around? Or are you, what is the plan for this? Because this is a great topic. It just isn't, like you put it to me, what Trump did in the last 5 minutes. I mean, this is actually pretty meaningful stuff here. And I'd love to see it get a lot of attention.
Yeah, I would too. Well, book tours these days are mostly virtual. So you're part of it. It's easier and cheaper for the publisher, for the writers to do it by Zoom, and you don't have to fly out to California. Although I understand there'll be an event in Los Angeles at some point. I'm waiting to hear back on that. Perhaps an event in or two in Washington, D.C. as well. But mostly now we can do them from the comfort of our Zoom offices here, since we're all little mini TV studios now in this new, brave new world.
It's so true.
Get the word out, through people like you, actually, and, friends on the conservative side and also people who are not political, who are interested in military history and cultural history.
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping that it gets a little bit more broad recognition than that, because this is, I guess you can call it a conservative book. It really isn't. I mean, just to the extent that maybe the interest in military history is a little more, maybe a little bit more focused on people right of center. But I mean, it's fascinating. I've always loved military history. And so I got the book, and of course I open it up, and the first thing you do is check the indexes.
I don't think I put you in the indexes.
I'm not a military guy. I never served, so I wasn't looking for me. Although you're right, that's usually why I start with the indexes. Yeah. No, actually, what I wanted to find out, because I read the table of contents first, and I have to ask you about this because I think I grasp this, but I need to ask you about it because the Battle of Thermopylae is not one of the 12 battles that changed the course of Western history.
Right.
And I think that for people who are only lightly exposed to this type of thing, maybe you haven't delved into it, 300 made everybody an expert on Thermopylae, right? Which is bad because that's not exactly how the Battle of Thermopylae went, but it's a great story.
Right.
And it has its place, but it isn't really something that I would consider to be a history changer, sort of a history prep. And so it's not that you don't mention it. You mentioned it a few times in the book. Thermopylae does come up in your book. But so first off, why not Thermopylae?
Well, because it was in Last Stands, which was the book before this one. That book, this is the sequel. There you go. It was an easy answer. You set me up for an easy layup there. It's actually the opening of Last Stands, which came out 4 years ago and was a surprise bestseller. I mean, it was an enormous bestseller. And it appealed to people who like military history, but who like cultural history too. So sometimes I get some reviews. They're starting to come in on this book now. And we had 800 and some reviews of Last Stands on Amazon. People complained that, well, I didn't really focus on the battles in the way that they had. In other words, I didn't write the book that they would have written it, could they write, but which they can't. But you get that a lot as an author. But I'd like to put each one of these battles in a very broad cultural context. And that means, as I always do, dragging in music and art and culture and literature and plays and poetry and all the things that surround our lives, even though we're not as aware of them as we might have been once before. And clearly you had to start with Thermopylae, which was, of course, a history changer. But the only reason that it's not in this book is it was in the last one.
Right. it's a history changer, but you know, I think that the ones that you choose here, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, mm-hmm. because I think that maybe Thermopylae is to a certain extent famous for being famous. It's a great story, right? 300 soldiers stand in the gap. Great strategic story, except for the part where the path to get around them existed.
When you get surrounded, then you're in trouble. Yeah.
Then it becomes a little bit, but I mean, there's lots to talk about. It's a little bit famous for being famous though. And I think that what we're looking at here is for the most part, really important battles that maybe haven't come to attention, right? Austerlitz would be an exception to that. Obviously, the Battle of the Bulge would be an exception to that. But I think that what you're looking at here, what you tried to get to, are battles that matter that we don't really know much about, or we haven't maybe even haven't heard about. So tell us a little bit about how you went.
That's absolutely correct. Well, this book has kind of two levels. One is the battles themselves and my argument of how they changed the course of Western history. And the other is the commanders themselves and what aspects of their warfighting ability they share. So I trace a direct line in this book from Alexander the Great to George Patton. Not an entirely original thought, since Patton worshipped both Caesar and Alexander. But what was very clear to me as I began to conceive this book is that the best generals, starting with Alexander at a battle called Gaugamela, where he defeated Darius, the Persian king, and broke the Achaemenid Empire and was on his way to world conquest, or Caesar at Alesia, where he defeated the Celts, our people, the Gauls, led by Vercingetorix, and really created modern Europe, although he certainly wasn't thinking of that at the time. I wanted to know, what characteristics do they share? And I've argued both in Last Stands and in this book that war is a masculine preserve. I'm very much against women in the military. Certainly, I doubt their ability to command effectively in the field for biological and historical reasons. And so both these books are anti fourth wave feminist to a very high degree. But what you learn from looking at these guys is they have, beyond the fact that they're commanders, and that is people do what they tell them to do, more or less,
right,
they share a sense of knowing where the enemy is going to be 10 minutes from now, or 2 hours from now, or 2 days from now. So you mentioned Napoleon at Austerlitz, and that's his masterpiece, because it's a chess game that he got the Russians and the Austrians exactly where he wanted them on the battlefield he wanted. He worked that battlefield over. He scoured every inch of it himself. He was a get down in the mud kind of commander. And he knew what they were going to do when he put out a poison pawn, withdrew it, sucked their line around. And that's exactly what Alexander did at Gaugamela too. He put out a poison pawn. The Persians went for it, and Alexander hit them with that characteristic right cross to the jaw that he used to win every single battle he fought. Remember, he never lost a battle. So I was fascinated by how Patton's idea of, I'm the reborn soldier, you know, as Patton believed, he was kind of reincarnation, not necessarily of Caesar and Alexander, but of a soldier, is actually true, that these guys they all are the same guy in many ways, and getting into their personal lives and their effect on the culture is really what I wanted to do. I like the whole book, obviously, or I wouldn't have written it, but I think one of my favorite chapters is the one on Napoleon, because it's not just about Austerlitz and it's not just about Napoleon being a fighter. It's about Napoleon changing the whole idea of what it is to be an individual, to be the artist as hero. Remember, Napoleon started out as a novelist. He wanted to be a novelist. That's what he wanted to be.
Didn't know that about Napoleon.
He wrote a novel, and then he wound up, you know, it's a complicated story about how Napoleon rises to the top, but he starts out primarily as a novelist. And throughout his history of conquest of Europe, he goes to meet famous artists. At one point, he meets with Goethe. Goethe's living in Weimar. Napoleon is at Jena negotiating, you know, some peace treaty with the German states. And he asks to meet Goethe. So Goethe comes over from Weimar. It's not all that far. And they have this long conversation, which I reproduce in the book. But Napoleon was very conscious. He brought with him the opera and ballet companies in Paris to show the Germans that the French were civilized and that they also appreciated German culture. He had to work as an artist, a diplomat, a writer, a thinker, a lover. Obviously, he had at least 20 mistresses and 2 illegitimate children, not counting his 1 legitimate heir. He's a very complex guy, but the 19th century found him irresistible. Byron adored Napoleon. When Byron left England, mostly because he was afraid of being convicted for sodomy and he wanted to get out of the country, he built a carriage that was the exact replica of Napoleon's carriage at Waterloo, which had just happened. Franz Liszt, the pianist, was another sort of Byronic character, a dashing, handsome, looks a little bit like Napoleon, the young Napoleon before he got fat. Then Napoleon becomes a literary character. He's all over War and Peace. He stalks War and the very first sentence is about the Bonapartes in War and Peace, and it goes on for 1 million pages after that. So I think he was an enormously influential cultural figure in addition to being a military leader.
You know, I'm kind of curious about this too, and I don't know if your book gets into this. But one of the interesting things about Napoleon, Austerlitz, you know, for Waterloo for that matter, that sort of thing, is I think people forget this too, is that, you know, this is early 19th century when all this is taking place. And at the time, France was unified, but the German states were German states. Italy was a series of states, some of which was controlled, you know, by the Vatican, some of which weren't. How much did Austerlitz contribute to the later, not much later, projects, I guess you could say, you know, the momentum towards uniting the German states and uniting the Italian states?
A lot, because remember, Napoleon's done by 1815. He's done. He gets sucked into Russia in 1812, kind of sort of wins the Battle of Borodino, but that's another poison pawn. So he chases it to Moscow. The Russians say, okay, we got tons of territory, we'll just leave and you can have an empty city, which, by the way, we're going to set on fire too. And then he had to retreat back to France. But what Napoleon did up until the defeat at Leipzig, which really finished him, Waterloo comes a little bit later, and that's just a coda to his career, is he unified all the other European states against him. There was a series of things called the First Coalition, Second Coalition, Third Coalition, in which states with common interests found themselves opposing Napoleonic expansionism. And that did lead to the unification of the German states around the time of Bismarck, 70 years later.
And the Risorgimento, and the Risorgimento happens at almost the exact same time.
Yes, at the exact same time. Napoleon had conquered Italy, and in fact, he was king of Italy, and his son, little infant son, was named king of Italy. But Napoleon forced modern Europe on Europe, basically. He's the black, I'm so interested in him. He's the black swan of European history. He's this nobody who's actually Italian. His French isn't even very good, who comes from this island that France had only acquired sovereignty over pretty shortly before Napoleon's birth. Minor nobility, works his way up. He's the first self-made man in modern European history. Basically, he gets off the boat and he becomes emperor of the planet there for 10 years.
And this is, I mean, and that's a story in and of itself, but I'm glad that you focus this in a way that talks about how it changed Western history, because that particular, you know, I'm a dabbler in history. I wouldn't even presume to call myself a student of history, but I learned about the Risorgimento while I was in Italy. I think the second time I was there on business, and got a chance to look into that history. And, you know, I already knew about the unification of the German states. And it occurred to me then that this was in large part, a reaction, a nationalist reaction to Napoleon's imperial years. And that really did change Western history. I mean, dramatically changed Western history. And I'm glad that you landed on that.
Yeah, absolutely did.
Inflection point.
Well, the German states realized they had more in common with each other than they did with France, for example. So that's what began to allow Prussia to pull them, you know, with Bavaria, the long-standing holdout, because the Prussians and Bavarians hate each other. But they eventually came together in unification. To my point about the importance of the arts in this, which we in the 21st century have completely abandoned and forgotten about, how powerful artistic ideas were to the creation of nations. The slogan, as they were unifying Italy under Vittorio Emanuele, was Viva Verdi. Verdi, yes, the great composer, but V-E-R-D-I also stood for Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia. And it was a slogan that you could write, say, yeah, I love that Rigoletto. That's great music, man. But you're actually a revolutionary wanting Italy to be united under a single king. And that's a good example of why you can't just look at these battles as military encounters, because that doesn't tell you anything beyond the tactical level. You have to look at the larger, the strategic level, and then a point I get to at the end of the book, the objective level. Why are we fighting this war?
Right.
Why? What is the purpose of it? Now, you and I are both old enough to remember the Reagan administration. And when Reagan was asked, what's the objective in the Cold War? He said, we win, they lose. And that's all he needed to say. Then your generals go, okay, Mr. President, here's the plan of how we get to we win, they lose. My beef with the Bush administration, which I go into at some length in the last chapter, which is the battle of 9/11, is that they consistently failed to articulate an objective. And therefore, their officers, their flag officers, could not execute a plan that would result in anything but nothing, which is what we got. So I say we lost the battle of 9/11. And I've had some people say to me, well, prove it. And I go, have you been to the airport lately?
Yeah.
Do you take off your shoes? Do you take off your belt? Are you strip searched? Are you considered a potential criminal every time you walk into an airport because of the activities of 19 foreign Muslims? You tell me who won that war.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a great point. And it raises the point, too. I think that in each of these, with the exception of the last one, is that the combatants knew what they were fighting for.
Yeah. Most of them were fighting for religion. This is actually going to be the subject of my third book in this series about religious warfare. But in almost every case in these early battles, I start with the Iliad, because not only is it a great poem, but it does commemorate something that happened right around the Bronze Age collapsed in 1200 BC. So we've lost track with that part of the culture, except via Homer. But success or failure in battle was always, until relatively recently, attributed to either fidelity to God or insufficient fidelity. When the Christians won, it was Deus lo vult, God wills it. When the Muslims lost, as they did in the First Crusade, it was, we are insufficiently faithful to Allah. We have let our God down, and he has punished us for this. And loss is always in battle considered to be punishment by your God for your insufficient faith in him. And that's a very interesting idea. It's a very controversial idea. It enrages some people, because I had to talk about faith in this book a lot. One of the subjects of this book is Constantine, who wins the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, another battle no one's ever heard of, but it's the key battle to Constantine becoming the Western emperor and then the emperor of the entire Roman Empire in the fourth century. But remember, Constantine fought under a flag that said, in hoc signo vinces. Well, it said it in Greek, but in this sign, conquer. And it was either the cross of Christ or the Cairo, which is the
Greek. Cairo, but it was one or the other, yeah.
But there's two conflicting stories about this famous dream that he had. But he fought under a Christian symbol, even though himself, he didn't get baptized until the day he died. He stayed very much betting both sides of the equation, and the sun god his principal Roman deity, were, and then the Christian God came right at the very end. And in an amusing footnote to history, he's baptized by an Arian bishop, and the Council of Nicaea was called to basically, complexively, get rid of Arianism.
So, get rid of Arianism, yeah.
There you have it. So we go into Homoousianism and Arianism and Marcionism. I'm very interested in Marcion as a figure in the early church. Marcion rejected the Old Testament completely and was the first to come up with a version of the Christian scriptures that predates the official New Testament, which comes hundreds of years later. So all this stuff is connected, and I get very wrapped up in it because I'm really interested to see how all the parts move to create X. It's not just one thing, it's a multiplicity of things.
You know, Michael, I'm going to hold the book up again just because I like to make sure that we...
Thank you.
So it's beautiful art, by the way. Beautiful artwork on the cover. So, you know, A Rage to Conquer is the title. I find it interesting that you think, that, or not that you think, that people think that it's controversial to assign battle losses to a insufficiency of faith. The entire Old Testament speaks
Oh, very much so.
I mean, it's literally canon in world history, because that's what the Old Testament is, regardless of, you know, what, how you think of oral history. These are the things that were said and written at that time,
yes,
documenting things that took place. And that is the consistent attitude towards war. It's almost entirely, if it's not religious in nature, it's religious in application, meaning it was justified for religious purposes by right. The various different combatants. And I mean, that to me is almost a given. If you're going to talk about things like failures in especially in like the in terms of the Crusades, or if you're talking about, you know, Constantine and stuff like that, it's almost a given that you're going to assign the glory of a victory to your deity. And because you believe your deity is infallible, if you lose, you are the problem. And
yeah. Well, that goes all the way back to the Greeks, of course, because in the Iliad, certain gods are supporting the Greeks, certain gods are supporting the Trojans. So what you really have is a parallel structure of the war of the gods on Olympus and their human playthings on Earth. But they have a very complicated relationship with each other and with the deities and the human beings. So the Greeks understood this. That also, I started the book with the Iliad because it's also the first conflict of East meets West. And my theory throughout this book is that the real forever war is East meets West. That is to say, in almost every one of these battles, it's a Western European power, country, people fighting the East, whether they're Persians or Muslims or Turks or whoever they become, they always exemplify this East-West conflict, which is why we're still talking about Palestine and Israel today. This war has gone on for literally thousands of years, this conflict between East right. and... I mean, after all, what is Lebanon? What was Lebanon but the old Crusader kingdoms? It was a Christian country on the Levant, and it's been changed by Muslim immigration and the decline of Christianity in the birthplace of Christianity. But we have to remember this because it's not just superstition that somehow we've outgrown. These are long-lasting, built-in conflicts between our culture and other cultures, and the only way to understand them is to face them and don't deny that they exist.
You know, I can look at your list here and think of a couple that don't necessarily meet the East-West paradigm. One, and both of the two world wars might be that. Now, it's true that the Ottoman Empire was involved in World War One.
Yeah,
but I'm assuming that Pershing at San Mikhail really didn't really involve the Turks or the Ottomans at the time.
Right.
And then World War II, obviously we're fighting Japan, which is far east. Yes. So there's an element to that, but the Battle of the Bulge is really between what you would have considered in between the wars as two major Western powers Western powers.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not every battle is the East versus West battle, but I tried to start with the first famous battle, which is an East.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so many of them lead in that direction as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
Just because I'm interested. Yeah, I'm very interested. Yeah, I talk about dabbling in history. Well, I've read a lot about World War II, right? Mm-hmm. I've read Winston Churchill's six volume, which is fascinating, by the way, Winston Churchill's six volume book, The Second World War. I've read his book on the First World War too. I've read books on, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, I'm not an expert by any means. I'm curious, the Battle of the Bulge is very interesting. It's very significant. Patton, mm-hmm. it was Patton's finest hour.
Oh, yes.
Right? Turning on a dime, mm-hmm. marching 48 hours, you know, disengaging on one front to go fight another front, relieving Bastogne. It's a great story. And it's one thing I think that the movie Patton does a pretty good job of portraying in its context, right?
Yeah.
How did that change the course of Western history, other than the fact that it basically was the death knell for the Nazis?
Right.
I mean, is that what it was, or well, yes. is there something that, more significant than that?
That's a start, but I started this World War II chapter. It's in three parts. It's about Pershing at Saint-Mihiel, and it's about Patton at the Bulge, which are exactly the same battle. That's the point. So Germans punched through a salient called Operation Michael, and Pershing led, for the first time in history, an American army in Europe against the Germans. We weren't fighting with the French or with the English. They supported us. We didn't support them. And Patton was there with Pershing. So there's a direct connection between the two. In the middle of it, I chose Nimitz, who is the greatest of all naval officers, and the astounding victory at Midway, which sometimes goes unnoticed because the Pacific War lasted a long time. But it's important for Americans to remember, since we've gotten into this crazy notion of fighting for 20 years for nothing, that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in December of 41. By May of 42, they were beat. Their fleet was at the bottom of the ocean, and they never recovered from that. Remember, they sank four Japanese aircraft carriers at Midway, and that turned out to be a realization militarily that it wasn't the battleships that were going to be dispositive anymore. It was going to be the aircraft carriers, which had previously had a battle at the Coral Sea in which the two navies never encountered each other, but was entirely fought in the air. That's the same is true as of Midway. So these are important things to remember and understand. But the Japanese Empire was beat 5 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And then it was a question of how best to roll it up. Now, I am not a Douglas MacArthur fan, as the readers of this book will find out. good old Dugout Doug, who sat out World War II in Australia while Nimitz and the Marine Corps, I'm the son of a Marine Corps officer, did all the heavy lifting. Some of my prejudices are in this book, or they're not prejudices. I hope they're reasonable conclusions to be drawn from the facts at hand. But I think all of these things are far more complicated than we live in a post-Marxist culture of aggressor and victim and oppressor. And all of this is mostly crap and invented by the post-war Marxists of the Frankfurt School, which I treated in The Devil's Pleasure Palace 10 years ago.
Yes, you did. A fine book, too.
Well, it turned out to be a very influential book. Thank you for saying that. And kind of changed the argument a lot about what the nature of the enemy we're fighting. And I guess that's my point in writing these military books. Now, Last Stands was why men fight when all is lost. Men don't give up. They would literally rather die than lose. And right. That's something that women find almost impossible to understand, because it's not the nature of women to sacrifice themselves on the battlefield. I like to say on Twitter, which infuriates my detractors, that women should no more die on the battlefield than men should die in childbirth. The end. So each of these books is an ode and an examination of certain traits of masculinity. And in fact, I kind of call this book in praise of toxic masculinity, because everybody's seen A Few Good Men. And although the writer thought that the Jack Nicholson character was the villain, he's actually the hero of that movie, isn't he? he was stunned when he found it. The audience is watching. They're cheering Jack Nicholson and hating on Tom Cruise for annoying this guy who's trying to do his job. It's a very interesting time we live in, but I think to take advantage of the "what did Trump do 5 minutes ago" point, we're living in changing times. We are now appreciating the nature of what men do and how it's different from what women do. It's not necessarily better, it's just different, and that there is a delegation of responsibility and biological usage between the two sexes, and that war is a masculine province. It just is. Now we're moving into drone warfare, and God knows nuclear warfare would end everything. But up to this point, war has been, as I say in this book, the principal driver of technological and social change. As Kant says in the 18th century, war is the natural state, peace is the aberration. And we have wars kind of every 20 to 30, every generation and a half, or every two generations, to prove that Kant was right.
Yeah. Whether you want to lament that fact or not, it is a fact. And yeah, you know, not to get too far afield from your book, again, A Rage to Conquer by Michael Walsh, and again, holding this up because it's a lovely cover, and you should get the hard copy, and you can get that at your bookstore, where fine books are sold in brick and mortar style, or where fine books are sold, virtual style. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, I'm sure, are carrying this. Mm-hmm. But just like, I think we'll finish up on this, because it does have to do with what we're seeing in the last few weeks. Now, Pete Hegseth is a friend of mine. I've known Pete for 20 years. We're not close friends. We don't hang out and have Mai Tais by the pool or anything like that. But when he was being posted in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think it was in both, Afghanistan for sure. When he was back in Minnesota, we'd put him on the air to talk about the war.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to know him a little bit. He's a smart guy. He's a sharp guy, very friendly. But he has a very particular view that aligns with what you say, which is that, to quote Rush Limbaugh, the purpose of a military is to kill people and break things.
Yeah.
And anything that the military is doing that isn't focused on killing people and breaking things, or at least preparing to be, readiness for killing people and breaking things, is counterproductive to the entire reason you have a military.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm glad to hear him use the word lethality, because that's the point. That's the toxic masculinity in quotes that I've been talking about in both of these books. Now, in Last Stands, the prior book to this one, the last chapter was devoted to my own father's service at the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, which he fought in 1950. And I'd been born a few months before that. So I kind of grew up in a household of what does duty, honor, and country mean? And this has been denigrated and mocked by the left for a good chunk of my life. And I'm 75 now, and he's 99. He ain't going nowhere. He's perfectly fine, thank you very much. But it's good to see people like Hegseth, whom I have never met, talking that way, that we're seeing a restoration of kind of classic masculinity, which is making the left go nuts because they hate it so much. It threatens their entire worldview in a very visceral way, and that's why the antagonism is so great. You've set loose a nest of scorpions, and they're madly stinging in all directions because they're so angry. But I hope that Secretary Hegseth continues on the course he's already charted. The president has done very well by his appointments. I think Marco Rubio is probably everybody's surprise that he's really excellent at this job.
I'm not surprised. I've talked with him a number of times. He's a very sharp guy, and I knew he'd adapt.
Well, he's done a great job. And and the genius of Marco is he's a native Spanish speaker. So he doesn't go down to Latin America to deal with our hemisphere as some gringo who can barely say hola. He has a gravitas towards everybody from Tijuana down to Tierra del Fuego that the rest of us Anglo-Saxon Celts lack. And I think he was a brilliant choice. And I think all of the president's choices so far, Tulsi Gabbard, I'm a huge fan of, and I think she'll do a very good job as DNI. We've got the right, the right people in the right jobs at the right time. And now we have to withstand the assault of the left, because you know every 20 minutes the Times is going to run a story that says Trump fading, economy threatened, doom, gloom, loom. You know, it's like being a Boston Red Sox fan for all those years. Doom and gloom, loom for Sox, you know, in the coming baseball season. Well, we're standing up against it now, and we're pushing back. And I like to see these masculine virtues, which are not exclusively associated with men. Tulsi Gabbard is as tough as anybody. I mean, she is really an impressive person. And the other final genius of what's going on right now, I would say, is that you have Trump, a Democrat, Bobby Kennedy, a Democrat, Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat, who are no longer Democrats, who realized that their party left them, they didn't leave their party, and have moved on to bring very good and principled people into the Republican Party, and has changed the nature of the dynamic between the two major political parties. And I think that will be Trump's greatest contribution to American history. And we're watching it unfold right now.
I agree. Michael Walsh, we're going to leave it at that. But everybody, you got to check out this book, A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History by Michael Walsh. Also check out Last Stands and The Devil's
Pleasure Palace.
The Devil, I can never get that title right. The Devil's Pleasure Palace. Fine book from 10 years ago. I think I actually have two copies of that. Yeah. But get yourself a copy of this. Make sure to read it. And Michael, we got to do this a little bit more often than we've done in the past, but always great talking to you. Thank you for spending so much time with me today.
Anytime, Ed. It's always a pleasure to talk to my fellow Hibernian.